sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today we're going to look at war and the media, with a focus on Syria. 9/11 was the pivotal event that unleashed the U.S. war machine, and 10 years later, it's still going strong. Here's General Wesley Clark in a 2007 speech discussing what I would now call the 9/11 wars.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
So as you can see, the current wars in the Middle East were planned in advance and are still unfolding. Here's James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com talking about how the media repeatedly whips up support for the wars.
As the U.S. and Iranian governments escalate tensions in the already volatile Straits of Hormuz, and China and Russia begin openly questioning Washington's interference in their internal politics, the world remains on the knife edge of military tension. Far from being a dispassionate observer of these developments, however, the media has in fact been central to increasing those tensions and preparing the public to expect a military confrontation. As the drums of war begin to beat once again in Iran, Syria, the South China Sea, and other potential hotspots and flashpoints around the globe, concerned citizens are asking how a world so sick of bloodshed and a population so tired of conflict could be led to this spot once again. To understand this seeming paradox, we must first understand the centuries-long history of how media has been used to whip the nation into wartime frenzy, dehumanize the supposed enemies, and even to manipulate the public into believing in causes for war that, decades later, were admitted to be completely fictitious. The term yellow journalism was coined to describe the type of sensationalistic, scandal-driven, and often erroneous style of reporting popularized by newspapers like William Randolph Hearst's New York Journal. In one of the most egregious examples of this phenomenon, Hearst's papers widely trumpeted the sinking of the USS Maine as the work of the Spanish. Whipped into an anti-Spanish frenzy by a daily torrent of stories depicting Spanish forces' alleged torture and rape of Cubans, and pushed over the edge by the Maine incident, the public welcomed the beginning of the U.S.-Spanish War. Although it is now widely believed that the explosion on the Maine was due to a fire in one of its coal bunkers, the initial lurid reports of Spanish involvement stuck, and the nation was led into war. In many ways, the phrase infamously attributed to Hearst in reply to his illustrator, "You furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war," apocryphal as the story may be, nevertheless perfectly encodes the method by which the public would be led to war time and again through the decades. The U.S. was drawn into World War I by the sinking of the Lusitania, a British ocean liner carrying American passengers that was torpedoed by German U-boats off the coast of Ireland, killing over 1,000 of its passengers. What the public was not informed about at the time, of course, was that just 1 week before the incident, then First Lord of the Admiralty Winston Churchill had written to the President of the Board of Trade that it was most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores, in the hopes especially of embroiling the United States with Germany. Nor did reports of the attack announce that the ship was carrying rifle ammunition and other military supplies. Instead, reports once again emphasized that the attack was an out-of-the-blue strike by a maniacal enemy, and the public was led into war. The U.S. involvement in World War II was likewise the result of deliberate disinformation. Although the Honolulu Advertiser had even predicted the attack on Pearl Harbor days in advance, the Japanese naval codes had already been deciphered by that time, and that even Henry Stimson, the U.S. Secretary of War, had noted in his diary the week before that he had discussed in a meeting with Roosevelt how we should maneuver them, the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves, the public were still led to believe that the Pearl Harbor attack had been completely unforeseen. Just last month, a newly declassified memo emerged showing that FDR had been warned of an impending Japanese attack on Hawaii just 3 days before the events at Pearl Harbor, yet the history books still portray Pearl Harbor as an example of a surprise attack. In August 1964, the public was told that the North Vietnamese had attacked a U.S. destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin on two separate occasions. The attacks were portrayed as a clear example of communist aggression, and a resolution was soon passed in Congress authorizing President Johnson to begin deploying U.S. forces in Vietnam. In 2005, an internal NSA study was released concluding that the second attack, in fact, never took place. In effect, 60,000 American servicemen, and as many as 3 million Vietnamese, let alone as many as 500,000 Cambodians and Laotians, lost their lives because of an incident that did not occur anywhere but in the imagination of the Johnson administration and the pages of the American media. In 1991, the world was introduced to the emotional story of Nariya, a Kuwaiti girl who testified about the atrocities committed by Iraqi forces in Kuwait.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators, and left the children to die on the cold floor. It was horrifying.
What the world was never told was that the incident had in fact been the work of a public relations firm, Hill and Knowlton, and the girl had actually been the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. The public was whipped into a frenzy of hatred for the Hussein regime, not for the documented atrocities that it had actually committed on segments of its own population with weapons supplied to them by the United States itself, but on the basis of an imaginary story told to the public via their televisions, orchestrated by a PR firm. In the lead-up to the war on Iraq, the American media infamously took the lead in framing the debate about the Iraqi government's weapons of mass destruction not as a question of whether or not they even existed, but as a question of where they had been hidden and what should be done to disarm them. The New York Times led the way with Judith Miller's now infamous reporting on the Iraqi WMD story, now known to have been based on false information from untrustworthy sources. But the rest of the media fell into line, with the NBC Nightly News asking what precise threat Iraq and its weapons of mass destruction posed to America, and Time debating whether Hussein was making a good-faith effort to disarm Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Reports about chemical weapons stashes were reported on before they were confirmed, although headlines boldly asserted their existence as indisputable fact. We now know that the stockpiles did not exist, and the administration premeditatedly lied the country into yet another war. But the most intense opposition the Bush administration ever received over this documented war crime was some polite correction on the Sunday political talk show circuit.
Well, let me just ask you this. If they did not have these weapons of mass destruction, though, granted, all of that is true, why then did they pose an immediate threat to us, to this country?
You and a few other critics are the only people I've heard use the phrase immediate threat. I didn't. The president didn't. And it's become kind of folklore that that's what's happened. The president went...
You're saying that nobody in the administration said that?
I can't speak for nobody and everybody in the administration and say nobody said that.
The vice president didn't say that?
Not, if you have any citations, I'd like to see them.
We have one here. It says, some have argued that the... this is you speaking. Some have argued that the nuclear threat from Iraq is not imminent, that Saddam is at least 5 to 7 years away from having nuclear weapons. I would not be so certain.
Mm-hmm.
Close to imminent.
I tried to be precise and I've tried to be accurate.
Terrorist state poses a greater or more immediate threat to the security of our people and the stability of the world than the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
My view of the situation was that we believe, the best intelligence that we had and other countries had.
Remarkably, the public at large has seemingly learned nothing at all from all of these documented historical manipulations. If anything, the media has become even bolder in its attempts to manipulate the public's perceptions, perhaps emboldened by the fact that so few in the audience seem willing to question the picture that is being painted for them on the evening news. In 2008, CNN aired footage of a bombed-out Skinvali in South Ossetia, falsely labeling it as footage of Gori, which they said had been attacked by the Russians. This was immediately refuted by the cameraman who had actually taken the footage.
Today, when we arrived and news came that Gori was being shelled, I saw my footage. I said, that's not Gori, that's Skinvali. Having crawled through the length and the breadth of Skinvali, I don't need much to tell from which point this or that footage was recorded. I can swear in front of any tribunal. I can point at this location on the map of the town because I am the cameraman of the Rossiya channel videotaped that. It is 50 meters away from the entrance to the territory of the peacekeepers. Those guys who every move is regulated by the UN were all killed. The Georgians shot up their entire battalion.
In 2009, the BBC showed a cropped image of a rally in Iran, which they claimed was a crowd of protesters who assembled to show their opposition to the Iranian government. An uncropped version of the same photograph displayed on the LA Times website, however, revealed that the photo in fact came from a rally in support of Ahmadinejad. In August of 2011, the BBC ran footage of what they claimed was a celebration in Tripoli's Green Square. When sharp-eyed viewers noticed that the flags in the footage were in fact Indian flags, the BBC was forced to admit that they had accidentally broadcast footage from India instead of Tripoli. Also that month, CNN reported on a story from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, claiming that 8 infants in incubators had died in a hospital in Hama, where Syrian authorities cut off power in the area. Some news sites even carried pictures of the infants. The images were later admitted to have been taken in Egypt, and no evidence has ever emerged to back up the accusations. As breathtaking as all of these lies, manipulations, and so-called mistakes are, they in and of themselves don't represent the only functions of the media for the war machine. Now, the US government is taking the lead in becoming more and more directly involved with the shaping of the media message on war propaganda, and the general public is becoming even more ensnared in a false picture of the world, painted with the Pentagon's own paintbrush. In 2005, the Bush White House admitted to producing videos that were designed to look like news reports from legitimate independent journalists, and then feeding those reports to media outlets as prepackaged material ready to air on the evening news. When the Government Accountability Office ruled that these fake news reports in fact constituted illegal covert propaganda, the White House simply issued a memo declaring the practice to be legal. In April 2008, the New York Times revealed a secret U.S. Department of Defense program that was launched in 2002 and involved using retired military officers to implant Pentagon talking points in the media. The officers were presented as independent analysts on talk shows and news programs, although they had been specially briefed before their appearances by the Pentagon. In December of 2011, the DoD's own Inspector General released a report concluding that the program was in perfect compliance with government policies and regulations. Earlier this year, it was revealed that the U.S. government had contracted with H.B. Gary Federal to develop software that created fake social media accounts in order to steer public opinion and promote propaganda on popular websites. The federal contract for the software sourced back to the MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. As the vehicle through which information from the outside world is captured, sorted, edited, and transmitted into our homes, the mass media has the huge responsibility of shaping and informing our understanding of events to which we don't have first-hand access. This is an awesome responsibility in even the most ideal conditions, with diligent reporters guided by trustworthy editors doing their level best to report the most important news in the most straightforward way. But in a media landscape where a handful of companies own virtually all of the print, radio, and television media in each nation, the only recourse the public has is to turn away from the mainstream media altogether. And that is precisely what is happening. As study after study and report after report has shown, The death of the old media has accelerated in recent years, with more and more people abandoning newspapers and now even television as their main source of news. Instead, the public is increasingly turning toward online sources for their news and information, something that is necessarily worrying for the war machine itself, a system that can only truly flourish when the propaganda arm is held under monopolistic control. But as citizens turn away from the New York Times and toward independent websites, many run and maintained by citizen journalists and amateur editors, the system that has consolidated its control over the mind of the public for generations seems to finally be showing signs that it may not be invincible. Surely this is not to say that online media is impervious to the defects that have made the traditional media so unreliable, quite the contrary. But the difference is that online, there is still for the time being relative freedom of choice at the individual level. While internet freedom exists, individual readers and viewers don't have to take the word of any website or pundit on any issue. They can check the source documentation themselves, except, perhaps not coincidentally, on the websites of the traditional media bastions, which tend not to link source material into documentation in their articles. Hence the SOPA Act, Protect IP, the US government's attempts to seize websites at the domain name level, and all the other concerted attacks we have seen on internet freedoms in recent years. Because ultimately, an informed and engaged public is far less likely to go along with wars waged for power and profit. And as the public becomes better informed about the very issues that the media has tried to lie to them about for so long, they realize that the answer to all of the mainstream media's war cheerleading and blatant manipulation is perhaps simpler than we ever suspected. All we have to do is turn them off.
And again, that was James Corbett with Global Research TV. You can also check him out at CorbettReport.com. And now you're going to hear an interview on Russia Today with Sibel Edmonds, who was working as a translator for the U.S. government on 9/11. She was gagged by the Bush administration for what she knew. She now has a podcast called Boiling Frog. And here she is.
Well, hundreds of U.S. NATO soldiers reportedly arrive on the border of Syria. According to a former FBI official, hundreds of troops have mysteriously landed on the border and are training militants to overthrow the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But she says the U.S. media has been suspiciously silent about all of this. The whistleblower that is helping to bring this to light, Sibel Edmonds, joined me here in studio a little earlier to expose some of the details.
Well, my sources in Turkey and those also military sources here in the United States, and these are U.S. military sources and Turkish military sources familiar with the training of Syrian rebels in Turkey, in southern Turkey, in U.S. base, this Incirlik base in the southern part of Turkey, in Hatay area, since last May. And this is May 2011. And this story was confirmed by several high-level people from both sides, Turkish military and U.S. military. And we broke this story in November, on November 22nd. And no one in the U.S. media has reported on this, even though a week later this story was confirmed and it was publicized by major newspapers in Turkey, and nothing.
Why aren't we hearing this from the mainstream media?
Well, my sources told me that before they provided me with this information, a month before that, and this would make it around end of September, early October, they had gone to the New York Times and Washington Post and the New Yorker and some major popular alternative channels, and the editors there, they said they were not going to cover this angle and they would not provide them with any answer. And they were baffled. So basically, our website became the last resort for these people. And amazingly, the Turkish media, even though they've been under intense pressure by the government there, they've been reporting.
Well, it certainly is strange that we haven't heard any of these details. Want to talk to you a little bit more about what you do know. Where did these troops come from? Any indication of that?
Are we talking about the ones
on the Syrian border?
On the Syrian border with Turkey, these are the rebels who have been crossing the borders and military defectors that have been coming there since April 2011. But as far as the trainers are concerned, these are the Turkish arm of the NATO and U.S. military and intelligence personnel who've been working with Colonel Riyad al-Assad. and he's been in Turkey since May 2011, and he's been the one who has been making all the training and also communication with the rebels inside the Syria possible for U.S. NATO forces.
And when do you believe that the U.S. NATO forces arrived?
Well, they have always been in Turkey because they have a base. U.S. has a base, Incirlik base in Turkey. So they've been there, and now inside the base, they have had this division to train the rebels there. They also help the rebels smuggle arms into Syria, but also they have a communication division there in order to actually increase the number of defectors from the current Syrian army.
And talk a little bit more about what their mission is and what the U.S. NATO role is in training these militants.
Well, I don't have the details on that, but a lot of these activities had to do with the information wars, and that was to spread propaganda in Syria, to also help them as these are the rebels who carried the messages and the publicity created by the Turkish U.S. NATO forces inside Turkey, and also spreading information. And they also have access directly to all the military communication inside Syria because they're able to receive that information directly from Syria in the base there.
So you're saying that U.S. NATO troops are helping to spread this propaganda in order to topple this regime?
Or the twisted information that they want to cross and get it to the people in Syria, and also the leftover people, the people in the military with the Assad's regime.
And it certainly is strange that we aren't hearing about this. How can you verify, or how to what extent do you trust your sources, and how do we know that these are in fact U.S. soldiers?
Sure. My sources, first of all, I have officers within U.S. military, but I also have Turkish military sources who actually have been unhappy about these developments. But this story, after we broke the story, was confirmed by all the major networks and newspaper in Turkey, starting at the end of November. So they had their own sources, and these were the people who were able to go, and actually some of them had photographed the former military members from Assad's regime in southern Turkey, Hatay area, being trained with U.S. military personnel and the activities that have been taking place there. So if you were to go and look at the archives, Turkish newspapers have been reporting on this. No reports from the U.S. media, even though, I mean, the reporters kept telling us that, well, they are under pressure, they wouldn't want to jeopardize our troops, but, I mean, just those excuses don't make sense. And this is exactly what they did with us with Iraq. And similar incidents took place during Libya. And now, since May, they have been helping the U.S. government to cover up these setup, these preparations, these activities, starting May 2011. Because most people here in the U.S., they're under this impression that things are reactionary. Assad's regime is bringing about some atrocities, and some rebels there, they're going and fighting. They have no idea that all these setups and preps started in May 2011. So it is by design, and it's not some kind of simultaneously uprising situation where people are rebelling and then suddenly they are mysteriously armed, and mysteriously arms are being smuggled into Syria from Turkey. Well, who's providing these arms? Nobody's asking in the U.S. media. Well, these are U.S. arms shipped to Turkey, and from Turkey it's being smuggled into Syria.
So you're saying that there is a lot more to the picture than what the headlines expose after the fact?
Absolutely. And I would make the distinction between Western media and the media there, let's say in Turkey or in Middle East, because people there tend to get more of the real news information than people here in Western nations. And of course, that is by design too, because it is not the consent of the Middle Eastern people that the U.S. government is after. They want to line up support from Europe and people in the United States for the very soon to come war with Syria.
And lastly, Sabelle, I want to ask you why you decided to expose this information and why you think it's important for the public to know about this.
Well, initially, when I first got this information, my first question was, why are you coming to me? Why don't you go to the media? And I was told that, in fact, these people had taken these reports to all the major newspapers in the United States, New York Times, Washington Post, Pulitzer winner, journalists with the New Yorker, but they have been getting silence treatment, and in some cases they were told that they were not going to cover it, and this being the U.S. media. So when they came to us, we decided to check our, you know, with our other sources, and after we checked, we decided to go and print.
And do you think that these are all signs that maybe the media is working with the U.S. government or complying with orders from the U.S. government?
Well, that has been established for many, many years now. I mean, if you were to ask this, American people will tell you, at least those who are aware, we went through this with Iraq, we went through this with Libya, and we went through this with so many wars that we have had since 9/11, and this fits the pattern we have had before, and nothing is different. And if you go and speak with the analysts out there, they are looking at this information. Asia Times reported on this. Your news organization reported on this. These are the facts, these are the sources, and it makes sense. We have Jordan, we have Syria, we have Iraq. Well, we are basically surrounding Syria, and today we heard that Canada now is evacuating their citizens from Syria, basically telling us it's about to start, we are about to begin. Well, you don't start anything without prep, at least that's not the case with the United States military. You start doing the prep work. Well, this prep work started in May 2011 in case of Syria.
And now here's a clip from Press TV about more media manipulation when it comes to reporting the situation in Syria.
Qatar's aggressive stance towards Assad has led to a string of resignations at the country's Al Jazeera TV news channel. Those who left described bias at the station, which they say has become a tool to target the Syrian regime. RT's Paula Sneer is in Tel Aviv for us. So, Paula, tell us more about the accusations against the channel.
Well, we're receiving information now about the reported resignations of key employees in Al Jazeera's Beirut office, and they are claiming that the channel has a very provocative stance and has been involved in agenda-setting biased reporting. These resignations include the managing director, the correspondent, and the producer. And specific reports that we are hearing, particularly from the correspondent, is that Al Jazeera refused to publish pictures of armed fighters clashing with the Syrian army, and in addition, and also ignored a referendum on a new constitution in Syria. By comparison, the channel's coverage of events in Bahrain was minimal. It has practically ignored what has been happening there. In Libya, we are now receiving some kind of leaked information that the channel was involved in fake coverage and setups. And as you can well imagine, this is sending alarm bells to the international journalism agenda, because Al Jazeera was set up as a channel that was a mouthpiece of freedom and change. It was supposed to be a channel that was a revolutionary voice. But increasingly, we have heard critics say that it has become a one-sided voice for Qatari's government's stance, particularly against the Syrian President Bashar Assad. And our viewers, many of them will remember that almost miraculously, that was the word that was used by critics, last year Al Jazeera was granted a license to broadcast in the United States. And this is after it was initially refused such licensing rights. And this has led many critics to say that this granting was because of the channel's change in terms of an agenda setting, that it is very much pushing the agenda of the Qatari and Western governments that are calling for military intervention in Syria.
Just as the corporate media has manipulated and censored the news concerning 9/11, the Iraq War, it continues to do so concerning Libya, Syria, and Iran. I think James Corbett said it best when he said, "Just turn it off." And now I want to remind you that on Wednesday, April 18th, we'll be showing the movie COINTELPRO 101 on the campus of the University of Hartford in the Auerbach Auditorium at 7 p.m. Please join us. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.